I get buckets.
Three, Kobe, good! Bryant right between the eyes!
Welcome to Blue Wire Buckets. Today, I'm going to be your host of the pod, Mo Doc Hill. And today, I have Dan Favalli and Greg Mraz. Guys, how we
spectacular.
Doing?
Spectacular. Better than the Rockets, anyway.
The Rockets are going to have it.
I'm doing great. I'm a lifelong Warrior fan, so
Greg's
feeling pretty good, Mo.
Right now. He's chilling. But like Dan teased, the Rockets are down now 0-2. This was the series that we kind of thought was going to be a tight one, seven games. You know, we had a crazy few days of referee gate and audits and all of these things. I don't know about you guys, but let me just ask you straight away. What did you guys think of the officiating in this one?
I thought personally it was fine. I think at the beginning it looked like it was going to get a little testy because I think it was like within the first 2 minutes of the first quarter, Chris Paul hit the ground and wanted a call, and then he did sort of celebrate the first shooting space foul, which I think happened in the third or fourth quarter. It's all a blur, but I guess with the exception of teeing up both Nene and Draymond Green, fouls that are probably going to be rescinded, I didn't really take any issue with what happened with this game. I think it was probably as good. It went as well as the NBA could have hoped after what happened over the past couple of days.
I think that the eye injury to Harden was very much a subject of the game and somewhat took away from the officiating factor that people were talking about with all these comparisons of the kick out when he has a contested three and a non-kick out and it's just a straight up and down shot when he's left all alone. I think that the eye injury really dominated the focus of the game, but from what I could see, and also that the lead-in that Scott Foster was doing this game, I really thought that the referees called a pretty fair game on both sides. Like Dan said, with the exception of the Nene Draymond technical, I think that was unnecessary. I think that was
shout
just
out Ed Molloy.
Didn't Ed Molloy also throw out Durant in one of the games of the Clipper series?
I think he did. Mo, do you remember? I can't remember now.
I don't know. I mean, there's always something. I mean, I was with the Clippers, I think, during some of those stuff. But oh no, this was last week, right? We're talking. I'm getting old, guys. I'm mixing in my Clipper days with the Clippers series last week. You know what the thing is? Draymond gets into a fight with every ref. Like, does it matter? I mean, it doesn't matter who the ref is. He's going to argue with them, and there's going to be texts. And you know, I know there's a lot of stuff with Ed Molloy. That's there are issues with him and the Warriors and things like that. So it's just like, man, I'm tired of the refs in general being a topic.
Yeah, I think I'm right there with you. It does seem though that I'm pretty much pro player, and I don't think game one was consistently reffed at all, but it boggles my mind that we point to specific whistles over the course of the game, or we play so much stock in the last 2 minute reports, or we have these audits from game seven of last year being leaked at that time. I don't buy into officials determining games to that degree.
Yeah. I mean, like if we just go back to the game seven report, like, you know, for all the missed calls, they missed 27 straight shots.
Yeah.
Like that's hard. That's hard to do. I mean, listen, let me correct that. It's not hard for me to do. It's hard for an NBA player to miss 27 straight shots. That's what they did. I mean, like, we're going to cry about these things. It's like, guys, you had your shot. You blew it. 27 missed shots. Whatever you want to say about missed calls, you also still had the ability to win this game, this game seven, and you had the ability to win game one. You know, there were definitely mistakes in that game. And I just think I'm at the point now where I'm just over it. I don't expect consistency from the officiating just because I think it's three human beings. And then guess what? Next game, it's going to be three different guys reffing this game who are going to have a different set of biases and their opinions and interpretations of the way the game should be called. So, you know, we're just not going to have that consistency where every game's officiated the same way. And I think we really throw the refs under the bus, or the NBA throws the ref under the bus every time with these 2 minute reports.
I think that the one thing that has bothered me the most in particular about this particular circumstance is that I think it's relatively known league wide that James Harden gets the benefit of more non-calls, whether it's him leaning in on a three where he kicks out, or whether he doesn't get called for a travel when he steps back. The fact that the Rockets are crying foul over some of this stuff, to me, and I'm not just saying this from a Warrior perspective, I don't think there's a single player in the league that gets more favorable calls than James Harden does. So when he says, I just want a fair chance, to me that speaks of like, well, do you have any perspective of how anybody else sees you? Because the way the rest of the league sees you, it's that you get every call that nobody else would get.
I think just the reliance on drawing fouls on jump shots is, you know, that's shaky territory in general, particularly when you get to the playoffs, where I just don't know that you can expect the same calls or the same degree of calls, and especially in bigger moments of the game. I don't think most refs want to be the storyline, and I doubt they want to have a call like that be viewed as this determinant factor in a game as big as just a game one, round two playoff matchup. And so that's just, even forget about how many calls he gets, or it does seem like they're more favorable. I think he was in the 96th percentile of shooting fouls drawn on jump shots this year during the regular season. I just, you know, to use that as a crutch, that to me is a problem, and it's an exploitation of a rule that was put in place to protect shooters. Just when you look at his leg kicks on some of those contested threes, they're egregious, and there needs to be a line drawn. And I think most of the quote unquote no calls are probably the right calls in those situations.
Yeah, it's
Kevin Harlan had a great stat tonight. I'll let you go ahead, Mo, but I don't know if you guys caught this stat, but James Harden drew 95 fouls on 3-point shots this year.
Yeah, and
that is insane.
I think that's a league record, right? It's not even, league high. It's a league record, I think. It's not like he broke, I mean, it's just absurd. And the rules itself are kind of absurd and what they're doing. And I totally agree with what you said, Dan. But let's go quickly. Let's talk about the game itself that we just saw in game two. The Rockets are now down 0-2. I thought they played a pretty good game and still lost. Like, if I'm a little worried if I'm a Rockets fan, because if I look at the Warriors numbers, like, they still struggled from three, going 11 to 36, shooting 30% from three. Curry having a poor shooting night, and you still can't win this game. You know, what do you guys think going into Houston? You know, you're down 0-2. Do they have what it takes, you think, to really kind of win the next two games and make this a series?
Greg, I think this is where you say Warriors in four.
I'm just like, I am baffled at the way that Curry is playing in this series. I know that Durant is having one of the best four game stretches of anybody in recent playoff memory, but I'm absolutely baffled at the way that Curry is playing in this series. He was 3 of 13 from 3-pointer tonight. I mean, I know he was still like 6 of 16, got himself 20, which for Curry, like, yeah, he's shooting under 45%. Not ideal for him, but I mean, there's just something about him in these playoffs, especially with the fouls, that just seem off. But he has really been picked up by Durant, who is playing out of his mind, Thompson, who is seemingly awoken for the playoffs. And how about tonight's game from Draymond Green? I mean, I know that Draymond gets a bad rap for being this junkyard dog that people just don't want to deal with, but he scored 15 points tonight on 6 of 10 shooting. That is not a night you expect from Draymond Green. When you get that kind of night, that is a huge bonus.
Yeah, and I mean, even Andre Iguodala coming alive, just his regular seasons are one of the greatest cons in the NBA. Just lulls you into thinking that maybe this is the year he's regressed. And so he has a huge game for them. It's, you know, Curry's shooting, I would think it would pick up if he didn't have that dislocated finger. I would attribute at least some of his inefficiency to that, right, even though he didn't have a great game one. I picked the Warriors in five at the start of this series just because I thought the Warriors were awoken at the wrong time for the Rockets. When you look at what happened against the Clippers, you know, Los Angeles is punchy and deep, but if you're the Warriors, you don't want them to get to a game six. You had that whole, will Kevin Durant score or shoot more drama? And then he, as Greg said, goes on this now like 5 or 6 game tear, whatever he's on at this point. And, you know, the Rockets, I don't know how much of a better game they can hope to play. If you don't have 9 turnovers in the first quarter, maybe the game turns out differently, but they did a better job over the latter three quarters or over the latter half of limiting the Warriors in transition. So they can be a little bit better, but they don't have any real margin for error. And it's tough for me to imagine them just making this a series. And I don't think they seem like one two-way wing player short of being where they were at last year. And I know a lot of people have pointed to Trevor Ariza, but you know, they had James Ennis, and I think he could have been someone who made a difference in this series, but they move him just for tax reasons. So I think that's something, a move, one of many that sort of looms large in their, you know, championship hopes over how they've taken so much of a hit over the last year or so.
Yeah, I think, you know, the James Ennis, you know, being almost a cap casualty or tax casualty. And I think, you know, even Ariza, I'm part of the crew that's saying, you know, I think having Ariza would have made a difference. Because when you look at this team now, nobody can guard Kevin Durant. And that's clear. Like, the only way Kevin Durant won't have a good game or put up big numbers against him is if Kevin Durant chooses to be passive again. I just don't see that happening. I could see it. And I'm just going to say it now. If the Rockets don't win game three, they're getting swept. They're not winning game four. I think that's dead in the water. I think, you know, if they don't get game three, this thing's over in four. And that's kind of, it's actually going to really hurt their claim that they would have won, that they should have won game seven last year, just because now the Warriors have a healthy Iguodala, who, like we said, has kind of been playing possum all season. But I almost feel like the Warriors all year have been playing possum, with everybody kind of more concerned about the Warriors or whatnot. But that, it's enough about that series. Let's talk about the Bucks Celtics. The Bucks come out of this game. I mean, they definitely responded after, you know, Bud making comments of adjustments are overrated. He made a few nice tweaks to their defense. Giannis has a monster game, especially in the third quarter when the game really kind of busted out open. What was your guys' thoughts on this one?
For me, it's, you know, Giannis, you know, he ends up having a good game, and yet it wasn't even like a typical Giannis game. 7 of 16 from the floor is bad for him. He attempts 18 free throws, which I think is huge, and that's one of the things I'm sort of looking at for the rest of the series. I think Budenholzer was smart to put Mirotic in the starting lineup in place of Sterling Brown, but something that was sort of lost in Boston just thumping Milwaukee in game one was that Boston was hammered in that transition battle. And then they were hammered again tonight, outscored 23-11 on the break. And that's where Antetokounmpo is going to do just a lot of his damage and generate a lot of his free throws. So you can take away a lot of what he does in the half court, but if you can't stop the Bucks from getting out in transition, from really dominating that battle on the break, you're going to have problems, because the supporting cast is going to shoot better than they did in game one. We saw it. Chris Middleton came alive in game two. Eric Bledsoe came alive in game two. You had a better, I'll say, more measured game from Pat Connaughton, who in game one was just, he had, I don't know what, he was feeling it and none of his shots were going in. So I'm very interested to see, as much as we commended what the Celtics did defensively in game one, I'm wondering if they can address that element of what has actually hurt them. Just it didn't show up necessarily in game one, but through both of these games.
I think for Milwaukee, they showed tonight that when their supporting cast, like you said, Dan, needs to show up, they can show up. This, to me, has been the most talented and complete team in the East all season long. And I think that what game one did to them is said, look, we can't just win on talent alone, because Boston has been here before. They have gotten to this position, and they are upset about what happened last season. And so Milwaukee just needed to get woken up. And like you said, Dan, Chris Middleton waking up tonight, I think, was a huge factor in their success, because when they'll double on Giannis and you can get guys like him, Bledsoe, hopefully if they can get Brogdon back at some point, that'll be a factor as well. There are a lot of options that Milwaukee has from the outside, and I just look at this series as saying game three is going to decide a lot of it, because Kyrie was not very good tonight, 4 of 18 shooting. The Celtics just as a whole offensively were as pitiful as I've seen them since many of their myriads of struggles in the regular season. I want to know what you guys think about Boston offensively tonight, and just Milwaukee defensively was as good as they can be, but I just want your opinion on the Celtics shooting woes at this point.
Well, like I thought, I mean, you said you hit it right with Kyrie. Like, he was abysmal tonight. And I really think the Celtics as a whole, their shot selection was terrible. I think they held it too long. I think it was too much one-on-one stuff and not a lot of passing. I didn't see the ball moving as much as I thought it did in game one. But the other thing that really kind of irked me a little bit in this game was I didn't feel like they really attacked them in the pick and roll, especially Lopez in the pick and roll. You know, in game one, they got to the pick and roll. They got to the mid-range all night long, and they just kind of kept putting Lopez in it. And, you know, whether it was the ball handler hitting a shot or whether it was hitting Al Horford popping and hitting a shot, you know, they had 30 points in the mid-range that game. This game, I think they finished with 12, but really I think like six of them were when the game was already out of hand. I think they need to get back to kind of attacking Lopez and really kind of putting that pressure on their defense and finding that stuff. And I think they need to have better shot selection. Ball's got to hum a little bit. It's got to fly around the court. You know, when it gets stuck into these guys' hands for too long, you know, Tatum going 2 for 10 and whatnot, like it bogs down their offense and it allows defenses to lock in and get the turnovers they need to get those fast break points that Dan was talking about. So I think that's really the concern I have with Celtics offense going into game three.
Kyrie low key during the playoffs has just been rotating through a good shooting night and then a crappy shooting night. Like, his numbers look good in the aggregate for the most part, but he had some close to duds against the Pacers. And, you know, he goes 12-21 in game one, but then he was, 4-18 tonight against the Bucks. He's just had some pretty bad shooting games. When you can't count on Jason Tatum to shoot well, things get really murky. And Gordon Hayward's been someone who has stepped up for them a lot in recent weeks. But one, what type of load can you count on him to shoulder? And that's even when he had a good game in game one, you know, 8 shots in 30 minutes, I guess is fine. He's jumpstarting a lot of the offense, but then goes 1 of 5 in over 30 minutes of game two. They just don't have that clear second option yet, which is just so bizarre to say about this team when you look on the personnel with it. But when Marcus Morris ends up being your best offensive player for long stretches, there's a problem, whether it's the regular season or the postseason.
I mean, this would have been a blowout.
Shouldn't it be Jason Tatum?
It should be, but Jason Tatum needs to stop abandoning his drives. Like, his half-baked attacks are just so – his shot selection has improved since that whole, you know, Kobe-esque start to the season, but he just really lacks some sort of attack mode and settles too much. He's only a sophomore again, so while it probably should be him in theory, he's clearly not there yet.
Right, and this game would have been – a lot worse had Horford and Morris not had the first half they had. This thing would have been over before halftime if those guys didn't have the half that they had.
Al Horford is can we just say he's a beast? He's so good.
I laugh anytime somebody wants to criticize Al Horford. The only thing about I'm okay with criticizing Al Horford about is that weird thing where he ducks when a rebound is coming at him.
Tristan Thompson loves it.
But that's the only thing I'm going to criticize him about. Otherwise, I'm with you, man. He's a beast. He does everything you possibly want him to do on the court. And
he's the big fundamental.
There's only one big fundamental, Greg. We're not messing around with that. Okay. And that's.
Well, he's the equivalent of the big fundamental. I mean, you got to you love everything about what Al Horford does. And while you think that Kyrie is the, you know, the power leader of this Celtics squad, I mean, wouldn't you think that the spiritual leader of them has got to be Horford? Like, that guy's got to
keep
this squad
together, I wonder how vocal he is behind the scenes, because I feel like I've heard stuff where he's really not that guy. And I don't, you know, you would think that maybe he is. Again, I'm not inside the Boston Celtics locker room, but he seems more of like the on-court spiritual leader than he might be off the court. That seems more like a Marcus Smart territory to me. But maybe we can call him the demonstrative dabbler, just because he does basically everything.
I like that one. I'm with you, though. I think it is Marcus Smart who's really kind of that spirit within the locker room. I think he's just kind of the quiet lead by example guy. And he, you know who he is? He's the guy who, when he does start yelling or when he really does get on you, you listen, because you're like, wow, Al never does this. So this is definitely an issue. Let's go into the games that happened the day before. And I want to start with the Sixers-Raptors. The Sixers, after getting their butts kicked in game one, I mean, they were thoroughly dominated in game one, you know, came out with a pretty impressive win in game two. A few adjustments, you know, Joel Embiid guarding Pascal Siakam. Ben Simmons had the Kawhi assignment and did actually a pretty good job on him, even though they were doubling Kawhi whenever they could. He still did a pretty solid job himself one-on-one with him. And, you know, despite really a bad offensive game from pretty much almost everybody not named Jimmy Butler of their starting unit, they came away with a pretty tough win. Did you when you guys look at it, do you look at it as a fluke or is this a series now?
Can it be? I don't want to say it's both, but I almost looked at it as it was encouraging for the Sixers. But I think there's also silver linings for Toronto. You know, Ben Simmons made Kawhi's life difficult, but he still finished with 35 on 13 of 24 shooting. I did think that Simmons did a nice job of coaxing him into some more pull-up jumpers than he would have wanted and maybe just having him get rid of the ball more often than he would have wanted. But for this series, Raptors players not named Pascal and Kawhi are shooting under 29%. And so if you're the Raptors, the fact that you're tied 1-1 and that you were in a position to win game two still, knowing that some of those guys are going to get better, I almost just look at this and think that maybe the gap between these two teams is still larger than it might seem. And I guess the counter would be that, as you said, Mo, the Philly starters did not perform great, but Joel Embiid won't be sick every game, but how's his left knee doing? We've seen some kind of weird fits and starts from J.J. Redick, ditto for Tobias Harris. Jimmy Butler has disappeared until crunch time a bunch for them this season. So, and they're just not, you know, they're not deep overall. And so that they've won the bench battle so decidedly in game two, that's not something that's going to happen every night either.
I think Marc Gasol is going to wake up. That's the other thing. When you talk about the guys not named Pascal Siakam or Kawhi Leonard, Gasol is just too good of a player to be playing offensively the way that he is right now. I mean, last night's performance was maybe one of the worst playoff performances that he's had dating back to any playoff series that he played with the Grizzlies. I think Toronto is just a much more complete team. And like you said, Dan, like Jimmy Butler has disappeared at times. And there's a part of me that just feels like Jimmy Butler, when it gets down into that 2 minutes or less mode and it's a one or two possession game, he's just going to ISO that team to death. And I just don't think that they are as good of a team when he is in that mode. Now, granted, he can be very clutch. We saw that back in his Bulls days. We saw that somewhat last year with the Timberwolves. I think Jimmy Butler wants to be the guy that hoists himself up onto the mantle, but I just don't know if he's the type of guy that I want taking the shot in the last second. The problem with Philly is that I don't know who I do want taking that last second shot. And I just think that Toronto eventually is going to say, all right, we'll double this guy in the last minute. And you know what? If you dare Ben Simmons to shoot it, great. If you dare Tobias Harris for how he's been playing to shoot it, go ahead, do that. I just don't think Philly has got the shooters at this point outside of Redick. And then when he's playing well, Butler, I just don't think they have the shooters to consistently compete with Toronto.
Well, I'm going to push back on a few things, Greg, on a couple of things you said. The thing about Gasol is I think this is who Gasol is going to be in Toronto, at least for the time being, just because, you know, he's the new guy. He came in, got traded there. He hasn't averaged a ton of shots, you know, since he's been a Raptor. I think he went from 12 or 13 shots a night when he was with the Grizzlies this past year to after the trade about 7. And that's kind of where he's at now in the playoffs. And I think that's kind of what you got to expect from him. I don't think he's going to get a lot of shots. I think his job is kind of be more of a ball mover and things like that. It will help the Raptors if he shot more, especially from three, because he can knock that down. And we saw flashes of that in game one. But I just kind of think that's their issue there. I think it really just comes down to Kawhi and Siakam have to be really on, I think, for the Raptors to win these games. And I think the Raptors are going to win the series. But I think it's going to be a lot harder than people think. I think Philly's a tougher team than people think. I also think, you know, Butler's been good for them in the clutch since they got him. I mean, he had a bunch of clutch shots all through the regular season. He was big in the the Brooklyn series, you know, I think it's one of those things. I think it's that's his role, you know, is to kind of float around and, you know, Brett Brown keeps calling him the adult in the room. So that's kind of his job, right? He, when it starts to slip away or when they really need that big time bucket, he's the guy they go to. So, you know, how they act after they double him, then things will get interesting. But we haven't seen too much of that from the Raptors yet. Maybe they will if they get into another close game. I personally, I think it's a closer series than people think. I think we're going to have an Embiid game. I know there's questions of his knees and things like that, but I still think that's going to come, you know, besides the great post-game comments he gives us. I don't think, I think he's going to get over his the bubbles in his gut kind of thing. And you know, is going to have a big game somewhere, whether it's game three or game four. I think he's going to kind of step up. I think it's a closer series, though, than people think. I think a lot of people feel like, even though the Raptors lost these two, or I'm sorry, lost this game and, you know, didn't even play that well in game one besides the Siakam Leonard thing, I think it's closer than people are going to give Philly credit. And I think Philly's just a mentally tougher team than people give them credit for. That said, they're still not going to win the series. Toronto's the better team.
I actually agree with you with Jimmy. So there are probably very few players that can sort of float around during the game and then enter that closers mode. And he blends the best of Harris, Simmons, and Embiid in those crunch time situations. We saw it when Embiid passed out of that double team to him in the three. He could still work from those standstill positions like Tobias Harris. He can initiate the pick and rolls like Simmons, and he's just a bully when he gets into the lane or with his back to the basket like Embiid. When you have Simmons guarding Kawhi Leonard for most of his 40 plus minutes per game, and you're going to see him get Leonard as well on the opposite end defending him, I question what that does to Philly's macro level offense, because it probably puts you in a situation where Ben Simmons shouldn't have the ball in his hands as much. And when he doesn't have the ball in his hands with both himself and Joel Embiid on the floor, there are just so many things that can and will go wrong for the Sixers. And it's not even a matter of saying, well, we can let Jimmy cook earlier. Just all these guys, is there going to be the space for that to work, where you have Simmons and Embiid both off the ball at the same time, probably more than you want to. And then you get into the issue of, well, how do you stagger minutes then in that situation, because you want both Simmons and Embiid on the court? And that's where it really falls apart for me for Philly, because Mo, you said, I do think they are mentally tougher and just better than people think. I don't think they come close to being a proper, you know, peer for the Raptors, at least not right now. And it wouldn't surprise me if we've reached a point where Toronto rattles off three straight wins and this ends in five.
But, you know, Dan, the one thing I'd say, though, is they've already sort of have their lineup and rotation set and staggering, you know, they take Embiid and Simmons out, and that's when Harris and Butler are supposed to cook. And then they take those guys out and bring back Simmons and Embiid, and usually with Redick there, you know. And I think that's really when they actually can give Toronto trouble, because Toronto's bench everybody talks about how deep they are, but with OG Anunoby's appendix bursting and them having to have that surgery and him not being available, you know, the bench has not been good. Even in game two, even in game one, they were getting crushed by the Sixers. I don't expect the Sixers to get 10 points from Greg Monroe on a regular basis, or you know, they got a huge game from James Ennis offensively for 13 points. I don't expect that to be something that will continue throughout the series, but you know, we've seen guys step up for that team in the Brooklyn series. We saw Boban, of all people, you know, have a few big games when Embiid was out. So I think, you know, they kind of have their rotation set, and Brett Brown has kind of crafted this nice little staggered lineup where at least he always has two of these four guys, you know, always on the court. And that's not something that Toronto's able to match that often.
That's a fair point. And I think the point about the Raptors bench is good as well. We've talked about how they're probably going to peak at the right time all year, but they've been underwhelming for most of the season.
Yeah. And let's move on from that game, and let's talk about the Nuggets Blazers. Can the Blazers stop Jokic? Do they have anything they can do? Like, is there anything you can do to stop Jokic? Like, they don't have Nurkic. obviously. Ennis Kanter is, you know, with a separated shoulder. I mean, I don't know if you guys saw it. He made that dunk, and then as he came down, he was like, oh, that was a mistake. My shoulder hurts. You know, they're banged up in that area. You know, can they stop Jokic?
How dare you insult the defensive abilities of Illinois Fighting Illini legend Myers Leonard? And I say that went to rival school Northwestern. So, but in all seriousness, no, I don't. I just, the thing about Jokic that is incredible is that he is one of the most unique players of our time, just because of how much he can do offensively. I don't think I've seen a big man that is as good of a passer in the modern NBA as Nikola Jokic is. And if you're not telling me that he is what makes that engine go, then you clearly haven't watched enough Nuggets basketball this year. And also, I don't think I've clearly watched enough Nuggets basketball this year as well. But the performance that he put up last night, it's just a bad matchup for Portland. I mean, when you have a guy that is as skilled as Jokic is, and you're as thin on the front line as Portland is, I mean, Dame can go off all he wants. He can have a 39-point performance like he did last night. If you can't defend on the block against a guy like Jokic, and if they collapse on him, and then you kick out to a guy like Murray or Harris, or heck, even Millsap in the mid-range, like, you're in trouble. Like, for as good as Portland played in the OKC series, I think they have met their match. And like you said, Mo, and I'm interested to see what you say, Dan, I don't know what they can do to stop the uniqueness that Jokic brings.
My take would just be that they can't do anything. And he's so much harder to defend when you actually feel like he's going to shoot. And since that game 3 loss to San Antonio, he's averaging over 20 field goal attempts per game. And so if he's going to, you know, his pump fakes from 3 actually mean something now, because he's been taking a lot of them. And so a guy who's really going to look for his shot, but can still do all he does when he's catching the ball out of pick and rolls, even from when he's in set positions in the post or above the arc. And when he's moving with the ball, you always have to be on the lookout for those baseline cutters. There's just too much motion and too many things to account for if you're the Blazers. And again, to bake in just star level shot volume, it makes him impossible to defend. And so I'm interested to see what you think about this, Mo, since you've worked for basketball teams before. Everyone's talking about how thin the Blazers are on the front line. And I don't think, no matter who they really lean on, whether it's going to be Myers, Leonard, Ennis Kanter, Zach Collins, I just don't think they're ever going to match up with Jokic. So what would you think about just going the complete opposite direction? And this probably looks stupid after the game that he had, after how much Paul Millsap killed Portland's small ball fours. But what if you just used Aminu at the 5 with Harkless at the 4, and you round out your rotation with CJ Dame and then either Evan Turner or Rodney Hood, and maybe just try and play make the Nuggets into some awkward situations? Because that's almost where I'm at. It sounds drastic, but I just don't think any of the Blazers' size is going to be anything close to a viable match for what Jokic can do.
Yeah, I mean, they started to do that, you know, at the end of that game, and switching those pick and rolls Jokic and Murray. So they had Harkless on Murray to start and Aminu on Jokic, so they would be able to switch that. It's just hard. It's a tough thing. I honestly think with Jokic, I want him to score more than I want him to pass. I think his passing is more deadly than his scoring. So for me, I kind of want to invite him to have to be more of a scorer and try to take away those passes. Now, listen, it's very easy for me to say that sitting in my comfortable home in Los Angeles and not having to actually do it or put the game plan in. But I think that might be more my idea. I think, you know, when you have a guy as good as he is, I think you got to try to take one thing away, because you can't take everything away. So either you're going to try to stop him from scoring, which I just don't think they can. I just don't think they have the guys. If Nurkic was healthy, I think this would have been a really amazing series, just for the bad blood, the trash talk. I think there had been a lot more animosity on the court, which I tend to enjoy a lot more because of my sadistic nature. But the But I think I just don't think they can stop him from scoring. So at that point, and that's all due respect, Greg, to your boy, Myers Leonard. But to that end, I think that,
not my boy.
My bad. My bad. I think you got to just try to take something away. And I think for them, their best chances is try to take the other guys away and see if Jokic can beat you single-handedly. Because, you know, we know how it is with him. When he's cooking, he's scoring, he's passing, he's rebounding, you know, and he's finding guys on the backdoor cuts. I mean, Murray and Harris have really kind of developed great chemistry with him in that regard. So I think it's a tough cover for them. I think that game gets a little more interesting if CJ's able to hit a three. He went 2 for 7. He kind of struggled. I don't expect Portland to go out quietly. I think it'll be a battle. So, it's going to be an interesting game tomorrow night. I have no feel for, you know, kind of predicting who's going to win. I think it's going to be a fun one to watch because I'm going to be glued in to just see how they defend Jokic.
That's a good way to put the series, the no-feel series.
I need
series.
To see more from CJ.
The no-feel series. It's true. I feel like everybody feels that way, right?
Yeah, I couldn't. I picked Nuggets in 7 and had zero confidence for that pick.
I just think there was enough inconsistency from the Nuggets in what they did against the Spurs that makes you feel like it's the no-feel series. And then on the other side of the coin, you look at everything that Dame did against OKC and you felt like, all right, how do you not pick these guys to roll their way to the West Finals after the momentum they've been on? But then after you see what happened in game one, it's just like, yeah, I don't know. I think you need to see a lot more from CJ if Portland's going to have a chance to go back home with a 1-1 split.
And the one thing, too, I'll say is don't sleep on the effect of the high altitude. You know, they obviously it was Friday night, or I'm sorry, it was Saturday game 7 between the Spurs and the Nuggets. You know, they flew in on Sunday, played on Monday. You know, it's not like they had a lot of time to really get acclimated for the altitude and things like that. I wouldn't be surprised if we see a better showing from some of these other Blazers just because, you know, they've been in Denver for a few more days. They're kind of a little more used to the altitude and might be able to have a smoother go about it this time around.
Yeah, I don't have anything to add on this series. Again, the no-feel series is I want to see Portland get a little bit more drastic in game 2. I know you said that they tried the Harkless Aminu stuff later, but if things don't start to pan out in game 2 at the beginning, I'd like to see them lean into just super small in these I don't know if you can call them playmaking lineups because of what Aminu and Harkless cannot do as ball handlers, but that's just something I'd like to see them try if Jokic is still just eating so much.
Perfect. Well, guys, is there anything else you guys want to add? Did I miss anything you guys want to touch on?
No, I think you hit it all.
Myers Leonard for president 2020.
but see, he can't be your boy if you're going to push for him to be like he's either your boy and going
here,
for president
Greg.
Or he's not. I'm confused.
I'm just trying to rep the Big Ten. That's all I'm saying. There's not a whole lot of Big Ten love outside of Draymond in these playoffs at this point. So I'm trying to rep the Big Ten.
Yeah,
love.
But do you know why the Big Ten doesn't get a lot of love? Because you have 11 teams.
Actually, it's 14, Mo.
It's 14. Listen, no, that's it. We're ending the podcast.
I think moral of this story is that the Blazers need to dust off Scala BCA. I think that's my biggest takeaway.
Oh, man. Well, listen, everybody, you can catch my man Dan. He's the co-host of Hardwood Knox. I will have a podcast at some point going up on Blue Wire. Greg's always around. Thank you so much, guys, for listening to Blue Wire Buckets.